Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Nall, and this is the Progressive Commentary Hour. This is an original in-depth investigative report, Manufacturing Madness, the Pseudoscience of Modern Psychiatry. Imagine a happy, energetic 14-year-old girl living a normal life like most teens, despite being diagnosed with mitochondrial disease. That's a rare genetic illness that would sometimes impair her ability to eat and walk. One day, after coming down with severe flu-like symptoms, the girl's parents bring her to a children's hospital to see a gastroenterologist specialist. But before she has the opportunity to see the doctor, she is diagnosed by another team of physicians at the hospital with somatic symptom disorder. That's a psychiatric illness similar to hypochondria. The doctors claim that most of the symptoms the girl has are indicative of mental, not physical illness, and that she would need to begin treatment with psychiatric medication immediately. Appalled by the doctor's determination, the parents of the young girl attempt to discharge her from the children's hospital, hoping to bring her to her regular doctors, who normally see her for mitochondrial disease, so they can weigh in on the situation. But the children's hospital staff insist that the parents sign off on a new psychiatric treatment plan. After a few days, the hospital files a claim with the state alleging that the parents are engaged in, quote, medical child abuse and seeking, quote, unnecessary treatment, and petition the state to obtain custody of the child. The hospital is granted custody of the girl, and her parents are asked to leave the hospital by a police officer who claims that it'll all get sorted out in the courts in the morning. In the days to follow, the parents try to regain custody of their daughter but face staunch opposition from the hospital and state and the court system. Days turn into months, and the girl's situation becomes increasingly desperate. For the few minutes she is permitted to see her parents each week, her physical mental visibility declines. The parents notice that her hair is falling out and her gums are receding. She also covertly passes notes to her parents explaining she's being abused by the hospital staff. The notes state things like, quote, they hurt me all the time, push me all the time, and more. Despite the efforts of her parents and activists to have her discharged, along with even national media's attention, the girl remains confined to an oppressive psychiatric ward for over 14 months, with still no resolution, as my conversation. This is not a fictional story of a society gone mad. No, it's a true account of what is happening today to a 14-year-old Justina Pelletier of West Hartford, Connecticut, and her parents, Lou and Linda Pelletier, as they battle for custody with the Massachusetts Department of Child and Family. Horrifying cases of psychiatric establishments' exploitation and abuse of innocent Americans are playing out every day across the United States. But now it's time to take a closer look at the powerful and destructive influence exerted by psychiatric medicine in America today. In preparation for this special report, I interviewed more than 100 individuals. I spent more than 400 hours in research. I reviewed all the major medical literature on psychiatry and mental illnesses. I spent a lot of time reading the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual No. 5, the latest so-called guidebook by the psychiatric establishment. 26 years have passed since Prozac, the antidepressant drug, was introduced to the United States market and very quickly achieved the label of a wonder drug. In the decade that followed, other antidepressants, including Paxil, Zoloft, Luvox, and Celexa, would be released, creating an entire class of medications known as selective serotonin reuptake inhibitors. Since hitting the shelves, the popularity of the SSRIs has skyrocketed. Today, one in every 10 Americans reaches for an antidepressant daily. One in 16 children, all children, take psychiatric medications. And by the way, this ratio jumps to an incredible 25% of American women between the ages of 40 and 59. And that's substantial. Worldwide, mental illness is now the leading cause of disability among children. Active members and veterans of the U.S. military have become especially dependent upon psychiatric medications. Today, about 1 in 6 service members are using antidepressants or sedatives or other psychiatric drugs in an attempt to cope with post-traumatic stress disorder and other afflictions. From 2001 to 2009 alone, psychiatric drug use in this demographic rose by 76%. And in 2010 alone, the Pentagon spent $280 million on psychiatric drugs. Along with the rise in antidepressant use in recent years, we have witnessed the creation of many new clinical diagnoses in the field of psychiatry. What would have been considered just a few years ago to be rebellious behavior among teenagers is now termed oppositional defiance disorder. What was once looked upon as a child not wanting to do math homework is now classified as mathematics disorder. As the psychiatric establishment increasingly asserts its importance by pathologizing normal human behaviors, tens of millions of Americans are popping pills in an attempt to find mental well-being. All the while, Big Pharma is making a killing. In 2010 alone, SSRIs topped $70 billion. Now, considering how widely SSRIs are prescribed, you'd be forgiven for thinking that this class of drugs is highly safe and effective. In point of fact, these drugs come with a host of devastating and sometimes deadly health implications. Examining the state of medical industrial complex deeper still makes one thing abundantly clear. Psychiatry is not a science, but rather a massively subjective experiment fueled by a medical-industrial complex that seems to value profits over human life and well-being. But let me be specific. Let's break it down. First, facts. Psychiatric drugs are dangerous. Volumes of solid scientific evidence collected over the past quarter century demonstrate that SSRIs carry serious and sometimes deadly side effects. These adverse effects include akesthesia, a condition in which a person feels compelled to move around, can't sit still, and can't sit down. Permanent neurological damage, bone fractures, birth defects, sexual dysfunction, and suicide, especially in children and the elderly. Extreme acts of violence. Shockingly, evidence indicates that the SSRI's use in patients can, in fact, increase the length of bouts of depression and significantly promote relapse. But you say, one of the primary reasons to use them is for depression. That is the irony. Everything I am saying is supported by peer-reviewed independent literature, and a full list of all the scientific references are attached to the end of this report. But here are just some of the recent studies showing the harmful effects associated with the SSR drugs. Mind you, these are the mainstream scientific establishments' own publications and statements. New evidence suggests an association between autism in children and prenatal exposure to antidepressants. A 2014 study published in the journal Pediatrics, which surveyed 966 mother-son pairs, found that boys with autism were 3 times more likely to have been exposed to SSRIs in utero compared to normally developing boys. Research result presented at the 2011 American College of Cardiology meeting in New Orleans indicated that men taking SSRIs had thicker lining of the carotid media, a major artery found in the neck. Greater arterial thickness is a risk factor for stroke and heart disease. A large study looking into the effects of SSRIs and tricyclic antidepressants in postmenopausal women uncovered that women taking these types of psychiatric medications were 45% more likely to experience fatal stroke when compared to those women who did not take the drugs. a new study appearing in the British Medical Journal, which examined over 38,000 SSRI users, noted that approximately 1 in 5 patients experienced abnormally long electrical activity in the heart, known as QT interval. An extended QT interval can trigger irregular heartbeats, potentially resulting in dizzy spells, fatigue, and even sudden death. Research out of the University of Alberta in Canada demonstrated that patients taking SSRIs and tricyclic antidepressants were nearly twice as likely to develop type 2 diabetes than those that did not take the medications. Research published in the journal Psychiatric Intervention in 2013 unearthed a connection between antidepressants and symptoms associated with metabolic syndrome. Over a 16-week period, the study found increases in metrics including weight gain, body mass index, and total cholesterol among patients medicated with the SSRIs. Now, especially concerning is the alarming link between suicide and psychiatric drug use. At present, 22 U.S. veterans commit suicide every 24 hours. In fact, more active duty American soldiers are ending their own lives than are dying in combat. Could it be that the rising rates of suicide among members of the U.S. military are actually being fueled by SSRIs and other psychiatric medical use? A body of research suggests the answer is yes. A meta-analysis appearing in the British Medical Journal, which pooled data from more than 700 studies with 87,650 patients, found that there does exist, quote, an association between the use of SSRIs and the increased risk of fatal and non-fatal suicide attempts. The researchers stated in their conclusion that methodological limitations may have caused them to actually understate the real risk of suicide attempts. It's been 10 years since the FDA required SSRI manufacturers to place a black box label on their drugs stating suicide is a side effect of taking this class of drugs. How many more deaths have to occur before the FDA bans them completely? Fact: psychiatric drugs are not effective. Numerous studies show that the SSRIs are generally no more effective than a placebo, a sugar pill, in treating depression. The authors of a 2008 meta-analysis examining the effectiveness of using SSRI in patients with depression remarked that, quote, these findings suggest, compared with placebo, the new generation of antidepressants do not produce clinically significant improvements in depression in patients who initially have moderate or even very severe depression, but show significant effects only in the most severely depressed patients, end quote. Upon closer investigation, it's little wonder that these drugs aren't efficacious. Psychiatric authorities still contend that mental illness has its roots in chemical imbalances in the brain, particularly related to levels of serotonin, that may be mediated through pharmaceuticals. The only problem with this is the fact that no compelling evidence exists to confirm this hypothesis. A growing body of evidence actually debunks the chemical imbalance theory altogether. Further still, studies have proven that SSRIs disturb normal brain function, ultimately reducing the brain's ability to respond to serotonin. This is a possible reason that individuals on the SSRIs are more likely to suffer from depression for longer periods of time and relapse more frequently. Fact: psychiatric diagnoses have no basis in real science. The American Psychiatric Association's fifth edition of the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders is the definitive guide for psychiatric diagnosis. Of nearly 300 mental disorders outlined in the volume, not one of them is based on objective data drawn from double-blind, placebo-controlled studies. Rather, the criteria for determining mental illness are based solely upon subjectively described behaviors. There are no blood tests, no brain scans, no urine samples, not one biological marker to validate the existence of these so-called conditions. The flawed nature of mental health diagnosis has been pointed out for years, In a 2010 opinion piece for the Los Angeles Times, Dr. Alan Francis, chairman of the task force that created the DMS-IV, commented on the absurdity of the ever-expanding pool of mental disorders, stating the following, quote, "The first draft of the next edition of the DSM, posted for comment with much fanfare last month, is filled with suggestions that would multiply our mistakes and extend the reach of psychiatry dramatically deeper into the ever-shrinking domain of the normal. This wholesale medical imperialism of normality could potentially create tens of millions of innocent bystanders who would be mislabeled as having a mental disorder. The pharmaceutical industry would have a field day, despite the lack of solid evidence of any effective treatments for these newly proposed diagnoses." End quote. Even more damning was a deathbed confession in 2009 from the eminent child psychiatrist Dr. Leon Eisenberg. In his final interview, Dr. Eisenberg reportedly revealed, quote, "ADHD is a prime example of a fictitious disease," end quote. Now, the bombshell came at the end of Eisenberg's long career developing foundational theories in modern psychiatry that led to the creation of ADHD and other mental disorders. So, given the lack of scientific rigor with which the American Psychiatric Association concocts new disorders, it shouldn't come as a surprise that the DMS-5 even outlines caffeine use disorder or internet gaming disorder as conditions that warrant further study. The bottom line is that the psychiatric industry's diagnostic handbook is not credible. Fact: the psychiatric establishment is bought and paid for or influenced by Big Pharma. Like the other branches of the medical industrial complex, psychiatry is infested with conflicts of interest. One of the most outspoken critics of the pharmaceutical industry's extensive influence over the realm of modern medicine is Dr. Marcia Angell, the former editor-in-chief of the New England Journal of Medicine, who now serves as a senior lecturer and professor in social medicine at Harvard Medical School. In an essay she wrote in the New York Book Review, she recounts the systemic corruption that has plagued the field of psychiatry. From her, quote, "As psychiatry became a drug-intensive specialty, the pharmaceutical industry was quick to see the advantages of forming an alliance with the psychiatric profession. Drug companies began to lavish attention and lots of money on psychiatrists, both individually and collectively, directly and indirectly. They showered gifts and free samples on practicing psychiatrists, hired them as consultants and speakers, bought them meals, helped pay for them to attend conferences, and supplied them with educational materials. When Minnesota and Vermont implemented sunshine laws that required drug companies to report all payments to doctors, psychiatrists were found to receive more money than physicians in any other specialty. The pharmaceutical industry also subsidizes meetings of the American Psychiatric Association and other psychiatric conferences. About a fifth of the American Psychiatric Association's funding now comes from drug companies." End quote. Now, she goes on to describe how pharmaceutical companies manipulate studies to maximize profit from their drugs. Quote, "Drug companies make very sure that their positive studies are published in medical journals and doctors know about them, while the negative ones often languish unseen within the FDA, which regards them as proprietary and therefore confidential. This practice greatly biases the medical literature and medical education and treatment decisions." End quote. Upon further investigation, we find out that not only are unflattering studies concealed, while positive ones are the only ones publicized, but Big Pharma has become embroiled in scandals involving fabricated study results. It surfaced in 2009 that Scott Rubin, a Massachusetts anesthesiologist and researcher, had faked data for 21 studies on major medications. Several of the drugs reviewed in his area included Wyeth's antidepressant Effexor, which was shown by him in a favorable light. Evidence suggests that Rubin is not alone in this. A 2013 article appearing in The Economist titled Unreliable Research, Trouble with the Lab, covers the work of others, including a professor at the University of Edinburgh, who has studied the flaws in academic research outcomes. Here's what Dr. Danielle Finelli has to say. Quote, fraud is very likely second to incompetence in generating enormous results that are erroneous, though it is hard to tell for certain. Dr. Finelli has looked at 21 different surveys of academics, mostly in the biomedical sciences, and carried out more than a lot of studies, multiple studies, in quote, and they found that 28% of respondents claimed to know of colleagues who had engaged in questionable research practices. Collusion and deception have become hallmarks of the medical establishment. Here are some additional examples of psychiatry's corruption by the pharmaceutical cartel. A 2012 study carried out by psychologist Lisa Cosgrove and her colleagues examining the conflicts of interest in the Diagnostic Statistical Manual by panel members reveal how the stranglehold of Big Pharma on psychiatric medication has only increased in recent years. The authors of the study noted that, quote, 69% of the DSM-5 task force members report having ties to the pharmaceutical industry. This represents a relative increase of 21% over the proportion of the DSM-4 task force members. Cosgrove goes on to point out that panel members are eligible to help create the Diagnostic Statistical Manual as long as they are not paid more than $10,000 for drug companies per year or through consultancies. In addition, members are permitted to have up to $50,000 in stock holdings in pharmaceutical firms and still serve as advisors in these positions. The American Psychiatric Association meets in secret to develop the Diagnostic Statistical Manual. All task force members are required by the APA to sign a non-disclosure agreement. This practice has been assailed by many, even former DSM chairman Robert Spitzer, who stated in an interview, quote, when I first heard about this agreement, I just went bonkers. Transparency is necessary if the document is to have any credibility, end quote. In March 2009, the APA made an announcement that it would phase out the practice of accepting contributions from pharmaceutical companies for medical education seminars and food provided at conventions. The pledge was short-lived. However, less than 2 months later, the organization accepted $1.7 million from Big Pharma for its yearly convention in San Francisco. Groups such as the National Alliance on Mental Illness and the Anxiety and Depression Association of America, which are allegedly founded to advocate on behalf of people with mental disorders, have since been exposed as nothing more than front groups created to push Big Pharma's profit-driven agenda. In the 1970s and 80s, leaders at the National Institutes of Mental Health played a key role in helping found these groups, which have effectively lobbied lawmakers in Washington state capitals to fund more research into psychiatry. These organizations have enjoyed a steady stream of generous financial support from drug companies for years. Congressional records reflect that from 2006 to 2008, the pharmaceutical cartel poured $23 million into one of their accounts. Given the overwhelming evidence implicating modern psychiatry, designed for profit, and as a result, much human suffering, how could it be that this issue doesn't receive any substantive coverage? Why hasn't this been exposed by the New York Times, Dateline, in 60 Minutes? Could it be the hundreds of millions of dollars in advertising that the corporate media receives from Big Pharma each year? Perhaps this could lead to self-censorship. I will now take a deeper look at the dangers associated with the SSRIs, particularly Prozac. This drug consists of the single active isomer. The most controversial issue surrounding the use of the SSRIs, a possible connection to suicidal thoughts and behavior in some users, made news in mid-2003 when the FDA recommended that Paxil not be used to treat depressed children and adolescents because regulators were reviewing reports from clinical trials of an increased risk of suicidal thinking and suicide attempts in young users of the drug. Zoloft, Paxil, and Prozac were the top-selling antidepressants in the U.S. in 2001, and antidepressants themselves were the largest category of prescription drugs that year, with U.S. retail sales of $12.5 billion. Prozac was the leading antidepressant worldwide in 2000, but its share of prescriptions had been declining since the mid-1990s due to the competition from other drugs and from generic types. Eli Lilly's U.S. sales of Prozac fell 73% in 2002 following the introduction of generic drugs similar to that. Although the Prozac era had ended for Eli Lilly, the availability of less costly generics means that Prozac-type drugs may be more affordable for tens of millions of uninsured people. In addition to gaining approval for Prozac for indications besides depression, such as obsessive-compulsive disorder, bulimia nervosa, and panic disorder, Eli Lilly now markets two Prozac-related products that have their own patents. Serafin is the version of Prozac approved in 2000 for the treatment of premenstrual dysphoric disorder. It was the first prescription drug in the U.S. with this indication. And the second drug is Prozac Weekly, intended for the longer-term treatment of depression when symptoms have stabilized. It was approved in 2001. It has been noted, quote, that lifestyle indications for antidepressants should be examined. In addition to major depression, Paxil and Zoloft were indicated for panic disorders, post-traumatic stress disorder, social anxiety disorder. Zoloft also is approved for premenstrual dysphoric disorder, while Paxil is also approved for generalized anxiety disorder. Doctors, for their part, prescribe SSRIs for a wide range of conditions, such as headache, substance abuse, eating disorders, back pain, impulsivity, upset stomach, irritability, hair pulling, nail biting, premature ejaculation, sexual addictions, and attention deficit disorder. One growing market for SSRIs is their use with children, even though some studies have found that antidepressants are no more effective than placebos in these patients. A study in the Journal of the American Medical Association found that psychotropic medications prescribed to preschoolers had, quote, increased dramatically between 1991 and 1995 in the three cited studies. An analysis of prescription claims among young Medicaid patients in North Carolina found that the use of Ritalin-type stimulants and Prozac-type antidepressants among children rose dramatically in the 1990s and that more were taking both drugs at once. In 1998, 10.7% of children aged 6 to 14 were receiving stimulants, and 1.7% were receiving SSRIs. Lead author Dr. Jerry Rushton stated, quote, "The consistent increase in SRI use in dual prescriptions is especially surprising. We need further information about whether this is due to new unrecognized mental disorders, substitution for other therapies, or overprescription." Let's just take a look at serotonin for a moment. Prozac relieves depression, they say, by affecting the level of serotonin, a neurotransmitter that connects receptor sites and fires nerve cells. Dr. Joseph Glenmullen, a clinical instructor and psychiatrist at Harvard Medical School, explains in his book Prozac Backlash that the drug inhibits the reuptake of serotonin, a process in which a cell that releases this chemical messenger reabsorbs any unused portion of it. By blocking the reuptake of this neurotransmitter, Prozac boosts the level of serotonin and prolongs the serotonin signals in the brain. Dr. Glenmullen points out, however, that neurotransmitters like serotonin and adrenaline and dopamine are connected by complex circuitry and function interdependently. Changes in one neurotransmitter can set off changes in another. Thus, the idea that Prozac-type drugs work selectively on serotonin is incorrect. When the level of serotonin is artificially increased, the primary reaction in the brain is to drop down dopamine, a powerful secondary effect that was not understood when the new class of serotonin boosters was introduced. The severe effects of SSRIs are thought to be caused by the connections between serotonin and dopamine systems. Quote, drugs producing a dopamine drop are well known to cause the dangerous side effects that are now appearing with Prozac and other drugs in its class, end quote, Dr. Glenn Mulan writes. His term for these compensatory reactions in the brain is, quote, Prozac backlash. Dr. Peter Bregan also reports in Talking Back to Prozac, What Doctors Aren't Telling You About Today's Most Controversial Drug, that Prozac acts as a stimulant to the nervous system. Therefore, it can produce side effects that mimic those of amphetamines and are exaggerations of the desired effect of Prozac in relieving depression. According to Dr. Bregan, the FDA psychiatrist who wrote the agency safety review of Prozac stated the drug's effects, including nausea, insomnia, and nervousness, resembled the profile of a stimulant drug rather than a sedative. Dr. Bregan notes that nearly all of the Prozac side effects listed in the physician's desk reference, quote, fit into the stimulant profile. Among others, these stimulant symptoms, including headache, nervousness, insomnia, anxiety, agitation, tremors, weight loss, nausea, diarrhea, dry mouth, anorexia, and excessive sweating. He adds that the antidepressant factbook show that all these SSRIs can cause insomnia, anxiety, agitation, and nervousness. The same effects in others are caused by the classic stimulants, like amphetamines, methamphetamines, and ecstasy, and cocaine. A drug that acts as a stimulant also can overstimulate the body's systems. In Talking Back to Prozac, Dr. Bregan offers the example of a person who takes Prozac to relieve depression and suffers from agitation and insomnia. Now, these adverse reactions, quote, are inherent in the stimulant effects that produce feelings of energy and well-being. In this sense, the difference between therapeutic effects and toxic effects are merely steps along a continuum from mild to extreme toxicity. The Food and Drug Administration has received 45,000 plus adverse reaction reports on Prozac. It is not unusual for serious adverse effects to surface after drug has hit the market, perhaps requiring that a major new warning be added to the label or that the drug be withdrawn. The FDA informs doctors, but not the public, that the approval of the drug does not mean it is safe. An analysis of 548 new drugs approved between 1975 and 1999 was published in the Journal of the American Medical Association, 2002. It found that 56 of the drugs acquired a black box warning or were withdrawn from the market. There was a 20% chance that problems would arise with any given drug after its approval. The researchers concluded that serious adverse drug reactions commonly emerged after FDA approval. They add, quote, the safety of new agents cannot be known with certainty until a drug has been on the market for many years, end quote. Dr. Glenn Mulan says that popular psychiatric drugs follow a 10, 20, and 30-year pattern in revealing their dangerous effects and falling into disfavor. About 10 years after their debut, the earliest signs of problems appear. At 20 years, there's enough data for the problem to be undeniable and a significant number of physicians to voice their concerns. And at 20 to 30 years, professional organizations and regulators actively work to stop overprescribing the drug. At this point, drugs have become passé and lost their patent protection, and the manufacturers move on to more profitable drugs, quote, that can be promoted as safer because their hazards are not yet known. The SSRIs have no more specific effect on depression than do other antidepressants, including the tricycles and monoamine oxidase inhibitors, according to Dr. Charles Medawar. As he explained, quote, in the antidepressant web, patients generally respond to antidepressants in about 60 to 70% of cases, while the typical response to a placebo is 30 to 35%. Therefore, the popularity of SSRIs is due to the fact that most experts believe they are safer or otherwise more acceptable than the alternatives. And in fact, promotional messages for SSRIs state three advantages. The drugs produce fewer unwanted side effects, are more acceptable to more patients, and are safer in overdose. Despite the safety-related claims made in the medical literature, however, quote, the evidence overall does not suggest that SSRIs show any great and decisive safety advantage over alternatives in day-to-day use, end quote, according to Dr. Medawar. Consider the results of trials comparing the SSRI efficacy and safety with that of other depressants. Quote, two independent meta-analyses, each starting with a careful search of the literature to identify all properly controlled trials, have reached broadly similar conclusions. The SSRIs do have the edge on alternatives, but not by much. One analysis of 62 trials found a 49% drop rate versus 54%. A second analysis of 63 trials found 3% fewer people stopped taking SSRIs because of their side effects. Other recent reviews have also found that the newer antidepressants are no more or less effective in treating depression than older generation drugs. In a government study conducted by Dr. Cynthia Mulrow and colleagues, the researchers analyzed more than 300 randomized controlled trials and concluded there was no significant differences in efficacy between newer and older agents or in overall discontinuation rates. Fewer people taking SSRIs stopped treatment due to adverse effects than those taking first-generation tricycles. More than 80 studies did find that newer antidepressants were more effective than placebo in treating major depression and results. A more troubling conclusion was reached by Dr. Irving Kirsch and colleagues who analyzed data sent to the FDA for approval of the six commonly prescribed antidepressants between 1987 and 1999. These were Prozac, Paxil, Zoloft, Effexor, Suzone, and Celexa. Their analysis found that the response to placebo, a sugar pill, was almost as great as the response to the antidepressants. The mean difference on the Hamilton rating scale for depression was 2 points, according to a report in Psychiatric Times. The difference was statistically but not clinically significant. The article states, quote, more than half the clinical trials sponsored by the pharmaceutical companies failed to find significant drug-placebo differences, and there were no advantages to higher doses of antidepressants. The small difference between antidepressants and placebo has been referred to as, quote, dirty little secret by clinical trial researchers, end quote. Several recent studies have reported similar results, finding that the SSRIs do not differ significantly from sugar pills in the treatment of depression. How many people walking around today with a mental disorder diagnosed would, just a few years ago, been engaging in normal behavior? Perhaps they were experiencing a lot of excitement and acted hyper. Maybe they were undergoing a period of grief and anxiety or depression. Historically, you would have worked through these conditions. Today, there's no working through them. More often than not, you are diagnosed, prescribed, and treated forever. And that is the issue. In addition to the questionable efficacy of these psychiatric drugs, it has become clear that many antidepressants carry a host of side effects. And I think that we must be aware of this. The adverse effects include akesthesia. As I noted a few moments ago, people may suffer from a variety of side effects when the central nervous system is overstimulated. Studies show that two effects of overstimulation, akesthesia and agitation, are experienced by people frequently taking the antidepressants. And akesthesia can be defined as a need to move. A person feels anxious or irritable and is compelled to stand and pace, shuffle their feet. Prozac can also cause extreme agitation. Eli Lilly states in Prozac information sheet that the drug can cause akesthesia. However, the company has said that less than 1% of Prozac users experience this side effect, while reported in the Journal of Clinical Psychiatry has estimated the actual share of Prozac users suffering from akesthesia is up to 25%. Typical symptoms include restlessness, constant pacing, purposeless movements of the feet and legs, and marked anxiety. You always have bruxism, grinding of the teeth, maybe another form of side effect. And also a tendency to violence. Other researchers know that patients who take Prozac and develop akathisia may in turn become preoccupied with thoughts of suicide. One article reports on three patients who attempted suicide during fluoxetine treatment and were then re-exposed to the drug. The second time around, all three developed severe akathisia and said the condition made them feel suicidal. They also attributed their previous suicide attempts to this. According to one reviewer, studies have suggested that fluoxetine, quote, may in fact lead to suicidal behavior because the drug appears to adversely affect the neuronal discharge and induce an akathisia-like reaction. Dr. Robert Lane, a scientist at Pfizer, the maker of Zoloft, notes in a 1998 article that the occasional occurrence of SSRI-induced side effects, including akathisia, may be, quote, a consequence of the serotonin-mediated inhibition of dopamine system. But there are other neurological effects. A number of movement disorders have been linked to the use of Prozac and other SSRIs since the drug's introduction. In fact, in a report in Psychiatric Times, Dr. Raphael Leo says the movement disturbances associated with SSRIs among the adverse effects that were unappreciated in preclinical marketing trials. Although their occurrence may be rare, these side effects are clinically significant and should be of concern to clinicians. In a book in 1996, in a review, Dr. Leo found 671 cases of SSRI-induced symptoms. The side effects included dystonia, Parkinsonian conditions, tardive dyskinesia-like states, and this was just one sample. The literature links fluoxetine to a variety of specific neurological symptoms, including acute dystonia and reversible dystonia. Also, tardive dyskinesia. I'm sure you've seen people who've had this, jerky movements and facial tics, and that's a consequence of this kind of drug. And it goes clear back, however, that it was also seen in people using other drugs in the 1960s and 70s. The risk of adverse neurological effects from the SSRI also extends to newborns whose mothers took the drugs during late pregnancy. According to a 2003 article, this prospective controlled study found a significant 400% increase in serotonin-related symptoms during the first 4 days of life between the infants exposed to SSRIs and a control group. The most common symptoms included tremor, restlessness, and rigidity. By 2 weeks of age, no significant difference in symptoms were detectable between the two groups. Other articles suggest that prenatal exposure to SSRIs may have subtle effects on infants' motor development and motor control, and that prolonged exposure alters the neonatal acute pain response. In Prozac Backlash, Dr. Joseph Glenmullen presents the view that all of the neurological side effects of the SSRIs originate in the brain's involuntary motor system. And while the exact mode of action is not known, the leading hypothesis is that an unnatural boosting of serotonin affects the levels of dopamine. It is the dopamine that has been implicated in these neurological disorders. And Dr. Glenmullen says, and research shows, quote, a strong link between serotonin and dopamine in the involuntary motor system. He quotes one researcher who states, quote, serotonin seems to modulate dopamine function, and points out that the elevation of serotonin causes a compensatory drop in dopamine. In three separate studies, reductions in dopamine were caused by Prozac and Celexa and Zoloft. Dr. Glenmullen concludes that, quote, the Prozac group's much-touted selectivity may in fact be a liability. Boosted beyond ordinary levels, elevated serotonin could trigger a dangerous backlash, a compensatory drop in dopamine, resulting in the drug's most severe neurological side effects, end quote. Prozac is not selective, then, if it has indirect effects on other neurotransmitters. And he cites research showing that SSRIs affect neurotransmitters besides serotonin and dopamine. But one of the most acute problems is psychosis. A person's nervousness may reach a psychotic level when the overstimulation of the nervous system is severe. People can become paranoid, extremely depressed, suicidal, and dangerous to others. The mental effects of fluoxetine treatment have been discussed in several reports. In one study, the SSRIs and newer atypical agents, 8.1% of all admissions to a psychiatric unit of the general hospital during a 14-month period were due to antidepressant-associated mania and psychosis, meaning the side effects. The ability of Prozac-type drugs to induce mania and hypomania in patients has been documented in numerous medical journals. Studies have also shown that Prozac can produce mania or mania-like symptoms in children and adolescents. A clinical trial of 40 youth from 11 to 17 with obsessive compulsive disorder found 30% of those treated with SSRIs developed manic and hypomanic symptoms. Patients taking fluoxetine experienced mania at doses as low as 10 milligrams a day. One study suggests that mania associated with antidepressants may be a distinct clinical entity from spontaneous mania, with episodes that are milder and more time-limited. Then you have suicide. It is so severe. Beyond the link between akathisia and acts of violence, some users of these SSRIs have said that the drug caused them to develop suicidal thoughts and obsessions. This aspect of the drug has generated controversy and led to discussions in both medical publications and the general media about the connection between the SSRIs and suicide and acts of violence. It should be noted that in several studies, the findings suggest that the SSRIs did not lead to suicidal preoccupation or found that the drugs were not associated with an increased risk of suicidal acts. The safety of the drug also is supported by literature reviews. Reports on clinical experiences with them and its effects following an overdose and reports on clinical trial results or an analysis of pooled data clinical trials. But it's serious. The association between the SSRIs and suicide is not easy to dismiss, however. As Richard de Grand Prix reports in The Lilly Suicides, the FDA has received 2,000 reports of suicide by Prozac users up to spring of 1999, and the FDA itself has estimated that only about 1% of serious side effects are reported to its adverse event system. Dr. David Healy, director of the North Wales Department of Psychological Medicine at the University of Wales, has used figures from Eli Lilly and independent research to estimate that, quote, probably 50,000 people have committed suicide on Prozac since its launch, over and above the number who would have done so if left untreated, end quote. That's a serious number. 50,000? The estimate would be much larger if all SSRIs were included. That was just one drug. The controversy over the SSRIs, suicide connection, flared up again in June of 2003 when the Food and Drug Administration recommended that Paxil no longer be prescribed to children and adolescents under the age of 18 to treat depression. The agency was reviewing reports of a possible increased risk of suicidal thinking and suicide attempts in young people who took the drug for major depressive disorder. The researcher under review also showed that Paxil is no more effective than placebo in treating these patients' depression. The FDA's warning closely followed a statement by the UK's Committee on Safety of Medicine that Seroquel should not be used for depression in the under-18 population. In late October 2003, the FDA then issued a public health advisory to healthcare professionals regarding reports of suicidality in clinical trials for various antidepressants in young people with major depressive disorder. Preliminary data for 8 drugs suggested an excess of suicidality reports for patients assigned to several of the antidepressants compared to those taking a placebo. What follows is just some of the research on association between Prozac and other SSRIs and self-destructive thoughts and behavior. In the Paxil matter, the results of three unpublished placebo-controlled clinical trials showed that the risk of suicidal thinking and suicidal attempts was about three times greater with the under 18 Paxil users than with the placebo group. When releasing this information, the FDA said, quote, there is no evidence that Paxil is associated with an increased risk of suicide thinking in adults. But it didn't say in children. In a 2003 review, Dr. Healy showed a randomized controlled trials, meta-analysis of clinical trials, and epidemiological studies of the SSRIs and suicidality, concluded, quote, the data reviewed here make it difficult to sustain a null hypothesis that SSRIs do not cause problems in some individuals, end quote. In a large-scale analysis of clinical trial data for psychotropic drugs approved by the FDA between 1985 and 2000, Dr. Kahn found that patients attempting or completing suicide substantially more often than expected. The analysis included more than 71,000 patients treated with atypical antipsychotics, including the SSRIs and other drugs. And according to the article in Clinical Psychiatry News, on Dr. Kahn's presentation at the meeting of the new clinical drug evaluation unit sponsored by the National Institute of Mental Health, the findings, compared with a suicide rate of 11 per 100,000 people per year in the general population, the suicide rate per 100,000 were 752 in antipsychotic trials, 718 in antidepressant trials, 425 in trials for social anxiety disorder. That's a substantial increase. Remember, 11 per 100,000 in the regular population and 752 in the antipsychotics. A 1990 study reported on the, quote, surprising possibility that fluoxetine, which was Prozac, may induce suicidal ideation in some patients, end quote. The study conducted by Dr. Martin Teicher and colleagues at Harvard Medical School concerned six patients who were depressed but not suicidal before they started taking Prozac within weeks of taking the drug. Said the researchers, the patients experienced, quote, intense, violent, and suicidal preoccupation, end quote. In an analysis of 1,017 patients treated with antidepressant drugs by 27 psychiatrists, researchers found 3.5% of those who took Prozac, along with 6.5% of those who took tricyclics, became suicidal only after their treatment began. The researchers concluded that the incidence of suicidal ideation was not significantly different between patients taking Prozac alone and other drugs. According to Dr. Glenn Mulan, however, when Dr. Teicher of Harvard Medical School reevaluated the data of Dr. Fava and Dr. Rosenbaum, he found that Prozac patients were at least three times more likely to develop new suicidal ideation than those taking other antidepressants, the older ones. Other experts have agreed with Dr. Teicher's reanalysis. In conclusion, I have found dozens and dozens of studies that, for whatever reason, have not made it into the mainstream media, and for whatever reason have not been analyzed by the Food and Drug Administration, the National Institutes of Health, and our National Institute of Mental Health. To the contrary, all that we seem to hear is that most Americans suffer from some form of abnormal behavior and most likely caused by brain chemical imbalances to which a quick diagnosis and a prescription will lead them into a better state of mind. They simply have no science to support it. We have a great deal of science to be concerned about what has happened to a society that now has been pathologized to the point of not knowing what is truly normal. I'm Gary Nall. Thank you very much for listening to this special edition, an investigative report on manufacturing madness.